Hello, I'm Dr. Amalia Gonyas-Malka. Welcome to Womanity, Woman in Unity, the show that celebrates women's milestone achievements in their struggle for liberation, self-emancipation, human rights, democracy, and much more. Joining us today is Professor Catherine Chu, who is a professor of global surgery and is the director of the Center of Global Surgery at the University of Stellenbosch. She is a general and colorectal surgeon who received her undergraduate degree from Stanford University. She completed her medical degree and general surgery residency at the University of California, San Francisco. She was a Fulbright Scholar at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, where she received a master's degree in public health and developing countries. She is an adjunct professor at the University of Botswana, a board member of the Consortium of Universities for Global Health, and the inaugural director of the Center of Global Surgery at Stellenbosch. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Prof Chu, you have an incredibly interesting career that's taken you all around the globe, going in, let's say, almost reverse chronology and starting with your current role. According to a 2015 report from the Lancet Commission for Global Surgery, two-thirds of the global population, i.e. 5 billion people, don't have access to safe, affordable surgical care. And the majority of those live in low and middle income countries. As I understand it, the Center for Global Surgery was founded in 2019 with a vision for a world with equitable access to quality surgical care for all. Global surgery sounds like an all-encompassing expression. Can you give us a brief description of the field?
Absolutely. I mean, I do think that the term global surgery is not that descriptive. And so what we really mean by global surgery is surgical health systems, or getting the surgical care to people when they need it. So first of all, none of us are born or hope to have operations, I don't think anyway, but many of us are struck with, for example, a cancer we didn't expect to have, or to get into a bad car accident, and suddenly find ourselves needing surgery. And oftentimes surgery is a time-sensitive need. If you need it, you might need it within an hour, within a few weeks. And as you mentioned, there are many people around the world, 5 billion to try and put a number on it, who cannot get access to surgical care when they need it. And if they can access it, sometimes the quality of that is not that great. So global surgery is talking about health systems around getting people the surgical care they need. And in many parts of the world, including in Africa, people living in rural populations, for example, cannot access surgical care when they need. And for sure, in a country like South Africa, where we have a private and a public health sector, the public health sector has a lot more burden of disease. 80% of the population is accessing the public health sector, but the public health sector has less than half of the resources, both human and financial. So there are the waiting times, and the facilities that are available are fewer in the public sector. And so we say that the healthcare isn't equitable or accessible for all.
So given that surgery is, as you said, time sensitive, it's not something that can necessarily have a delay to it. How do you see the ability of the systems improving so that there is equitable access? Because if you're in the private sector, fine, you will pay if you've got that affordability, and you will pretty much instantly get the surgery that you required. But if in the public side of things, how do you see the system starting to change?
Yeah, so I mean, I think first of all, from a policy level, there isn't a coordinated surgical plan in South Africa or in other African countries, for example. And so, for example, other health conditions like HIV or TB, there's a national plan to address this. Which facilities are we going to use? What are our strategies? What are the human resources we need around that? So in South Africa, we don't have that specific coordinated plan. Historically, surgery has been left to the tertiary and sometimes regional hospitals, so the bigger hospitals, which are usually located in big cities. But the district hospitals, of which South Africa has 200 to 250 of those spread out in each of the provinces, and the district hospitals is sort of more the closer hospital for people living in rural areas, those hospitals don't traditionally do surgery. And there's no sort of official mandate that they need to, or even if they did, what kind of operations would they deliver? So back to your question, how can we make surgery more accessible? It would be to increase the number of facilities that offer surgery, and also to consider either training more surgeons, anesthesiologists, obstetricians, or using other caterers or groups of doctors or other health professionals to deliver some of that surgical care. So, you know, within surgery, there's highly complex and sophisticated operations like liver transplant. We're not advocating that that should be done at all the small district hospitals, but there are other procedures. For example, cesarean section is the most common operation. Women in labor may need an emergency cesarean section because of obstructed labor to either save the life of the mom or the baby, or if they've had complications in the past, need an elective cesarean section. But that is an operation that can be done at a district hospital and doesn't always need to be done by the specialist obstetrician or have a specialist anesthetist. Sometimes it does. So there will always be people who need specialized care that need to go to the big tertiary academic centers. But the majority of people with surgical needs can be operated at what we call lower or smaller health facilities, but that are located closer to them. So especially if it's time sensitive, and there would be overall more facilities that would be able to offer that. But in order to be able to do so, the country would need a plan of how to train more people appropriately, because you cannot just ask anyone to do a cesarean section or to amputate a leg or to do a hernia repair or to fix a broken femur or to take out an appendix if they haven't had the proper training. There is no doubt that in South Africa, and even more so in other African countries, there are not enough fully qualified surgeons or fully qualified obstetricians. However, there has been good evidence from other countries that you don't always need a fully qualified surgeon to do some of these procedures. There are family physicians who also have training in surgical care and operations, as well as medical officers who have been working in surgery for a long time that could also be taught safely how to do some of these procedures. But this would require coordination from the specialists. So for example, a surgeon working at a tertiary hospital would need to link up with those working at district hospitals, almost in what we call a hub and spoke manner. So even if it's just remote support, those doctors would be able to contact the surgeons at the bigger hospitals to discuss patients as needed. What kind of plan should they make? Does this person need to be transferred? Could we handle it here? And also there needs to be some guidelines of what types of operations would be safe to do at district hospitals. But this could all help.
So greater capacity building in terms of not everyone has to necessarily be a surgeon, but you can have other skills and be upskilled in your area. But very importantly, improving coordination across the board and organizational structures. What triggered your interest in global surgery?
So, I mean, I think, you know, my background is I was trained in the US, and where we have much more resources, both in terms of the number of hospitals that provide surgery, as well as the number of surgeons, anesthesiologists, obstetricians that, you know, all work to provide the surgical care. And then I switched into working for Doctors Without Borders, or Medicine Sans Frontières, which is a medical humanitarian organization, which delivers health care, specifically surgery, in either conflict areas, disaster areas, or places where the health system really doesn't function, meaning that there's nobody delivering surgical care. And I think there I saw that without a good system around delivering surgical care, you can't really sustain this as a service for the population. You know, you can sort of fly in and do 100 operations and fly out again, but, you know, without systemic support, without, you know, establishing a hospital that has laboratory testing, blood transfusion capabilities, x-rays, how would you diagnose some of the problems and how would you treat them? And obviously then running the operating theaters as well. So I think working for MSF, for Doctors Without Borders, it showed me how important the whole health system is. And that was something in the US that, you know, we would take for granted. So maybe just a simple example is that, you know, in the operating theater or the operating rooms, we call them in the US, you know, when everybody's ready, the patient's prepared, the patient's anesthetized, they say, doctor, the patient is ready for you. And you as the surgeon just walk in and everything is laid out, the patient's asleep, and then you scrub your hands and you start. But in Rwanda, another place I went to work at, and this is sort of typical of the African scenario in the public sector and with the MSF, you know, if they say, doctor, your patient is ready, you know, I'd walk into the operating theater and the patient would be sitting there in a wheelchair and the room would be completely empty. No nurse, no anesthetist, no equipment, no gurney for the patient, no equipment set up, because a lot of these things in the health system weren't ready. You know, they weren't enough beds, so they were using the operating tables as gurneys. Then there was only one anesthetic machine and it was being used in another room. And so as the surgeon, you actually had to participate in this whole health system around getting the patient ready for surgery, literally meaning sometimes pulling in the operating table yourself, going to find the equipment, borrowing, you know, from someone else, finding an anesthetist. And so it just made me aware of how important all these factors are in making sure the patient finally gets the operation that they need.
In the Doctors Without Borders scenario, it sounds as though you were the healthcare system.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's an amazing organization that delivers surgical care when patients are in need. And, you know, in a disaster setting, when there's an earthquake or in, you know, typhoons, hurricanes, you know, they can set up and build a hospital within weeks. And as an organization, one would provide all the things, you know, build the infrastructure as needed, bring in the drugs, bring in the human resources, the surgeons, the anesthetists, bring in the nurses, and any equipment we would need for the operations. But again, that how does that link with sustainable healthcare in that country? It depends on what the capability of the country is, but sometimes it isn't great. And oftentimes temporarily, it's very bad, which is why MSF would then be coming in.
And in that space, personally, how did you cope with dealing with completely under-resourced environments, still being able to deliver on attending to your surgeries and patient care, but your own personal well-being?
So, I mean, I think that, you know, as doctors and specifically as surgeons, you're trained to treat the patient in front of you. And we haven't always looked at it through the whole health system lens. I mean, I think that oftentimes there's so much work in terms of the patient needs that you don't always think about your own, you know, when do you eat, when do you sleep, and kind of your safety, if you will. Luckily with MSF, in conflict situations, they are very good at having somebody in the project whose sole job is to negotiate with the rebels for safe passage, to find out where the fighting would be. It's not perfect, but, you know, you as the surgeon, that's not your job. Your job is to treat the individual patients. I think, though, what I did find very hard, and I know a lot of clinicians, doctors, nurses find it very hard, is when do you stop intervening? Because, but I'll give you an example. In Haiti, and I think it's 2008, we intervened during a series of hurricanes. And Haiti is one of the poorest countries in Central America, and at baseline has a healthcare system that doesn't function all that well. We went into an area where the hospital was flooded, completely destroyed. There were injuries, but there was also cases of infectious diseases, sometimes requiring surgery. And we set up a hospital within a few weeks, and, you know, we were busy operating on lots of patients. But at some point, the project coordinator says, okay, the acute emergency is over, and now we are leaving. But we had many patients. So, I mean, I remember having a 12-year-old girl. She had a typhoid perforation. So that's a perforation of the small intestine of a part called the ileum due to contaminated water that then carries bacteria, Salmonella typhus, and that causes this typhoid perforation. And so she had part of her intestine removed in an operation, but then she had what we call a stoma. So the stool was coming out onto her skin, requiring like a plastic bag. And this is supposed to be a temporary situation and needs to be reversed. And it can cause risks to the person, for example, dehydration or loss of fluids, electrolytes. And, you know, in a country like Haiti, where is this person going to get the special bags that are needed? There was no supply. But, you know, we had about a week's warning that we were leaving. And as a surgeon, it was very hard to leave a patient like this one amongst all many other patients who were sort of half cared for. But the decision was made that, you know, if based on the needs post hurricane, you know, we were back to baseline, but the baseline is so poor in terms of access that we felt that it would be likely that many people would, their health would worsen once we left. And also the infrastructure that we built, you know, we brought in supplies and some another organization was supposed to take that over. But even after we left the hospital, we were still in that town for a few days. But within those few days, the hospital stopped functioning because nobody could buy the fuel for the generator. So, you know, it is sometimes you want to do a lot of good, but sometimes you create expectations of care that cannot be continued. And you do sometimes wonder in the long run, are you doing as much good as you think you are?
Wow. So you've done a lot of the humanitarian work, which I understand was quite a contrast to your initial set of studies, which gave you a very specialized role within the colorectal space. What prompted you to do the shift?
Yeah, so I'm a first generation Chinese American. My parents were both immigrants from China. And so I was very fortunate to be born in the US and have sort of the opportunity to have all the best education, medical education and otherwise. But I guess I never really felt that it was my right to have all these training opportunities and to be born in a country as well resourced as the US. And so I guess I always kind of felt like there must be a reason that I was given this chance and opportunity to have all these skills, and they should probably be used outside the US. I wasn't 100% sure always during training what that was. And then I did work in Lesotho and Kenya during my senior medical school years. And I think for me, that was really eye-opening into how a doctor could be useful outside their own country. And I mean, I definitely saw that surgeons were extremely useful. This is back in the day when antiretrovirals were not available yet for HIV. And so the medical patients were often dying because there was no ability to treat them. But the surgical patients, you know, somebody would come in gored by a cow or stabbed by someone else and half dead, but the surgeons would operate. And within a week, the person would be walking out of the hospital cured. And I thought, wow, surgery could be really useful. And so sort of fast forward, then I finished my training and then I actually took a job in a very academic hospital in the US where there were many, many surgeons. In fact, there were 80 surgeons in that hospital. And I was only really needed for my specialty, colon and rectal surgery, but specifically for the anus and the rectum, which is just the last few centimeters of the intestine. And there were other specialty surgeons for all the others. And I guess I felt at that point that, you know, there were so many of us that if I wasn't there at that place anymore, somebody else could take the job. And perhaps it would be more useful if I practiced elsewhere. And I had met some people from this organization, Doctors Without Borders, through when I did my master's in public health in developing countries at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. And I heard they were opening up a medical unit in South Africa. So then to make a long story short, I joined their organization and then had opportunities to go out as a surgeon with MSF to different contexts. And, you know, again, MSF only does surgery where there really is no health system and no other surgical providers. And so as the surgeon out in the field, we say, you are really the only person that can deliver that care. So you're on call nights, weekends, and you don't just do colon and rectal surgery, you do, you know, obstetrics as needed. If you need to do urology, you need to do orthopedics, all kinds of operations. And so I think the skills were more useful in a broader context there. But then I guess that's also where I saw the need for a strong health system around surgery for it to be a sustainable service.
And do you think that insight into yourself of being able to use your capabilities and skills in areas that are under-resourced and have a dire need prompted you to spend 2 years training surgeons in Rwanda, which was, as I understand it, part of a mechanism to help rebuild their surgical training process?
Yes, and that was a fantastic opportunity and sort of came at a time when I was finishing up with Doctors Without Borders and sort of thinking like what would be the next step. So the government of Rwanda post-genocide applied for a human resources for health grant with USAID, you know, US-funded grant mechanism. And they essentially wanted to train postgraduate specialists. And so they had restarted a medical school, but they had no training programs to have surgeons, pediatricians, intensive care nurses, public health specialists. And so definitely surgeons was a group that they wanted to train. And so I was hired to go there and stay in country. And I stayed there for 2 years to be able to restart a surgical training program. Now, of course, we worked alongside with Rwandan colleagues. I mean, there the surgeons that were there were the ones that were going to stay on and continue to be trainers. We were helping train the trainers because what we had was the experience of having been through very formalized sort of postgraduate training programs with exams and a certain way of teaching at the bedside in the operating theater. So we were each twinned or paired with a Rwandan surgeon, and we, you know, learn from one another. Obviously, I learned a lot because the burden of disease in Rwanda is different, and they have a different health system and a different political background, and obviously a different historical context. But yes, it's been very rewarding, and I've been back to Rwanda a few times since then to be sort of an external examiner. And I think the last I counted, there were 18 surgeons still working in the University of Rwanda system that I had helped train, who are now trainers and fully qualified surgeons teaching other surgeons now. So
Well,
that's been very rewarding.
I'm getting goosebumps. That must be an incredible feeling that you've really impacted on the country's infrastructure. And as you were saying, the whole point of global surgery is about being able to empower health systems within countries.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, it has been very rewarding. I mean, of course, just having the human resources is often not enough, right? So, you know, now they're trying to deploy these surgeons to the district hospitals, but working in district hospitals is challenging because they're in rural areas. Oftentimes, then that surgeon would be the only surgeon. So they wouldn't always have colleagues. And, you know, most people like to work in a dynamic environment with colleagues to be able to discuss things and have resources like CT scanners and even X-ray machines to diagnose and care for their patients, intensive care units to care for patients that get quite sick. And so surgeons sometimes also feel out of their element being based at some of the more rural district hospitals. And so the system isn't perfect yet, but I do have to compliment Rwanda and their health system to say they have moved forward in leaps and bounds in the last 35 years or so.
I think that's a great testament that countries need to be proud of those accomplishments, because sometimes it is just about, as you were talking about Haiti, that kind of like base level of doom and gloom. But for companies that have managed to rise above it and have this aspiring trajectory, it's an important acknowledgement. You're listening to Womanity, Woman in Unity, and today we're talking to Professor Catherine Chu, who is a professor of global surgery and is the director of the Center of Global Surgery at the University of Stellenbosch. We would love to receive your comments on Twitter at WomanityTalk. Prof Chu, given your experiences, what advice do you have for aspiring female surgeons who want to make an impact in global health and global surgery?
Yeah, so maybe first is just to encourage young women who are considering medicine as a career and surgery as a career, just to say if you have a passion for it, go for it. Because there is no, I mean, surgery is an unbelievable field. You know, it's the privilege of caring for people, sometimes at their worst, at the most difficult time in their lives. And, you know, you walk with them, you literally take their bodies apart and put them back together, hopefully, for the better. But being a surgeon is a real privilege. But it is also, you know, if you like working with your hands, it's quite a technical field as well. And, you know, there have been some pretty impressive studies recently to say that females are actually even have better outcomes than male surgeons, which, you know, isn't always what sort of stereotypically true, because in Africa specifically, you know, at least 80% of surgeons across the board are male still, and still in many other countries, even in more well-resourced countries, surgery is still dominated by men. But just to encourage that, you know, female surgeons certainly have a lot to add to the field. And I think studies have shown that they're just as good or even better technically as men. I guess the other thing to say to women who are thinking of pursuing surgery is, you know, try to maintain what you feel is the definition of being female and being your own person. Because I think when I went into the field, you had to be as good as a man by pretending to be a man. Meaning that, you know, if you felt that it is your personality to show emotion or empathy towards the patient, that might be considered a weakness or soft. Or if you cried, if a patient died, you know, that would be sort of these female attributes. And I think things have really changed. And if they haven't in the country you live in or the school or the university you're training at, you can make that change because, you know, people training behind you see that if you're a surgeon, you show empathy and care and listen to your patient, that actually makes you a better doctor and a better surgeon. And I think builds even more trust. That being said, of course, you have to be technically excellent and you should always aim to be like that. And, you know, try your hardest in terms of learning about the management and the care of the patient, because I think, you know, that we can never compromise on. But surgery is a fantastic field, and I think women should definitely be encouraged to go into it.
Thank you very much for raising that point and being so encouraging and motivating. And I think that part of this is the ability of, irrespective of what role, job you take, is that you've got the power of changing some of those systems to become more female friendly. Competence is always there, but to allow and enable women to feel like women within the organizations of their choice. Prabhu, I wanted to ask you a more personal question. I mean, in this conversation, we've touched a lot on your career, which has been incredible. It's been diverse. It's been demanding. But you're not just a career woman. You're also a mom. As someone who has worked successfully to build your career, what are some of the tools that you use to balance the dynamic of having a home life and a full career?
Yeah, thanks. I have twins. They are 11 years old now. And yeah, I mean, I think balancing home and work or career is always, I think, challenging. But I think one of the things about, you know, so they were, you know, they've grown up only in Africa. And I think that one of the benefits of living and working here is that if you need help and you can afford it, that it is possible to have help. So we lived in Rwanda for the first 2 years of their life, and we all definitely had assistance, like childcare assistance at home. But also I have always felt that both in Rwanda and here in South Africa, that the healthcare staff have been quite open and welcoming to their surgeon or their doctors working at their hospital to have children. And that wasn't something in the US I experienced. You know, in the US, your home and your personal life were separate. And as a female surgeon, you never discussed your personal life, maybe because we were trying to be the same as all the male colleagues. But there are many times in both Rwanda and South Africa where I was on call and I needed to bring the kids with me in the middle of the night. And there was always somebody who was happy and willing to watch the kids as they got a little bit older. They're very much used to, you know, watching some of the operations from afar, of course, and not violating the sterility. But I do think that that also, you know, one of my children is a girl, and I do think it also shows them a positive image of what a working mom can be doing, you know, because I think if you explain to them what kind of work you do and what the greater impact of that role could be, I think that also helps. That being said, you know, there have been long weekend hours of call when, you know, I had to share my weekend time with my children. And luckily, I have an extremely supportive husband as well who's can step in. But, you know, now being more in the global surgery field where we're looking at health systems changes and not having to do as much on-call clinical work, that has also helped a lot in balancing a home and work life as well.
It sounds as though you've taken an integrated approach, and your kids don't know any different. This is what they're going to almost expect from themselves of work, home, that you can do everything.
Well, I hope they try to do an even better job than myself. But, my mother also was a working mom, but she always did try to come home, make dinner, be there for us. But I think also it instilled in me that a woman should and could have a career outside the home if she wanted to. And I think there was no doubt that my mom was very intelligent. And hopefully some of that has carried over now to the same values to show my children as well. So, yeah.
And I think that's also the important aspect. It's the ability to have choice and not have your choices and options taken away from you because you are a woman.
Exactly.
We're coming towards the end of the show, and one question I ask all my guests is, in a way, a little bit about their recipe to success. Some people will talk about a particular person, values, perseverance. From your point of view, what would you say have been some of the key elements to your success?
Well, I think that having passion for what you do, I know it sounds so cliche, but I think that is so important. I mean, I guess for me, always seeing the need for better care around surgical conditions, because surgical conditions are so dramatic and so life-changing and can threaten a life so quickly. And to see that large parts of the population don't have access to it, I mean, for me, that keeps me up at night. Like, it's really hard for me to see. My mother had breast cancer, and seeing like the resources that were available and not available to her. I've also had many sort of surgical conditions myself, and seeing how some people in the world can access the best care in the world just in minutes, and other people wait years for the same type of care. So I guess for me, that has always driven me to, continue to do my work. I think more recently, my passion has been that we've always looked at surgical care sort of in the hospital. What can the hospitals provide? How can we make more hospitals? But now our work is much more turning towards the person and their communities. In South Africa, people live in rural areas. There's a whole indigenous healthcare system with indigenous healers, and 80% of the population seeks care with those providers as well. So understanding how these different providers and how people make choices of where to seek care is so important now, I think, because you can build as many hospitals as you want, but if people don't want to come, or they don't trust the care, or they don't speak the same language as the person there. So I guess for me also now, it's not just surgery anymore, but it's just sort of studying and understanding people. So I suppose that drives me. But then maybe back to the overall question is, I think so one should try and pick something that you're really passionate about, that you can stay up for hours and days on end thinking about, because otherwise I think I don't think one would put in the time or the energy.
Yeah, passion is a strong fuel. And when you were talking about all of the different influences within the surgical structure, it really sounds as though it's systems thinking and design thinking, and that we have to be open to multiple points of view because we're all different and we've all got different experiences which impact on our own personal decisions.
Absolutely.
Can you tell us about some of the pivotal moments in your life growing up?
Yeah, I mean, I guess so. I was, again, my parents were from a different country, but I grew up in the Midwest in the US. And I guess I could make the analogy to like the Orange Free State, a very rural farming area. And the population was pretty homogenous. It was mostly white people of Christian background. And so my family didn't 100% quite fit in there. But when I was nine, my father was transferred to the Philippines, which is in Southeast Asia. And then we spent a year there and then a year in Singapore. And I think sort of being uprooted from a very small community, very stable, if you will, living in the same house from the day I was born, to a place where there are many more different types of cultures, ethnic groups, and where there are a lot more Chinese people. I think it's quite pivotal for me to see, like, huh, maybe, I don't quite fit into being an American just because I'm not like everyone else, but, perhaps like you don't always have to just be from one country, one place, but you can be sort of a bit more of a global citizen. But I think just understanding my sort of Chinese background. And then after I graduated from Stanford, where I went as an undergraduate. So in the US, we do pre-med first. We do an undergraduate degree, and then medical school is a graduate school degree. I spent a year in China teaching English. And, again, my family was from China, but I had never been there. And this was 5 years after the Tiananmen Square uprising. So this was 1994, and that had happened in 1989. And so for me, living in a country where it was of the people of my background, but I didn't understand communism, that was very eye-opening as well. And so I did feel like I connected a bit with sort of the culture of my family. And maybe not to always take what you hear on the news or by who's teaching you for granted. So I think ever since then, I've sort of been trying to look at what you think are facts with more critical eye, I guess.
Oh, that is such an important learning and a great example of looking at perspectives from different sides and making your own informed decision. Lastly, as we come to the end of the show, please can you share a few words of inspirational motivation for girls and women living on the continent?
Well, I guess I feel lucky to be female. I think we are the stronger gender, and I think that we can do everything that men can do, but probably better. But I do think that, I think women, we are born with a unique ability to nurture, to listen, to take care of, and to multitask, for lack of a better word, and to love. And I really think that we must embrace being women and females and girls, and just to push ourselves so that we don't feel like there are barriers set up by society of saying what we can't do. But I do think we are the lucky ones.
What a great message. Women are the lucky ones. Thank you so
Thank
much for joining us.
you for your time.
You have been listening to Womanity, Woman in Unity, and we have been talking to Professor Catherine Chu, who is a professor of global surgery and director of the Center of Global Surgery at the University of Stellenbosch.